Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Calajaris, Vice President of Marketing and Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute. And today, I'm very excited to introduce Dr. Kenya Odor, a human-centered research strategist and solution designer who serves as founder and managing director of Lean Geeks. Lean Geeks is a company that offers consulting, staffing, and coaching in user research and design. She's also held a variety of roles from user experience at IBM to director of user experience at LexisNexis, and just brings to this conversation a whole lot of experience with design and a big passion for really making design that has impact and delivers human value. So welcome, Kenya.
Thank you. That was a mouthful.
But, you know, like that's like the bio line. But just for our listeners, like tell us a little bit about your journey and your passion that brought you here today.
I love it. Thank you so much again for having me. What brought me here was a passion for people. I've always wanted to work with people, but I've also had engineering kind of chops in terms of wanting to create things and build things, and discovered human factors psychology way back when. And so that led to me reevaluating my career, going back to grad school, quitting, packing everything up, and moving to go and immerse myself into graduate school. And that's where I learned about human factors and the application in software development and product development organizations.
So obviously it sparked you, right? Like if you'd like kind of dropped everything and like this is what we're going to do. So tell me a little bit more about human factor psychology and why particularly it calls.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was at the time, the only field that I could find that was a unique synergy between understanding people at a cognitive and physical level and creating things as a result. And so it allowed me to find that sweet spot or that intersection between the two things that I was passionate about. And so I was able to look at the practical aspects of talking to people, which I love, learning more about them, what they need, that sort of thing, but then doing something with it. More than just, oh, that's nice, or, you know, nice to get to know you. It allowed me to take that information and apply it to something real and to see something tangible come out of those insights. That really, really intrigued me, especially early on in my career.
And I can see how that would feed just sort of both sides of your personality, sort of, right? Like the doer, the technical focus. I want to create things that are very tangible, but I want to, but I like that human connection, right? Mm-hmm. And just from a, I mean, I can see then too that that would drive a lot of how you've approached design. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's a good point. And so I think in the world of design, you have people who are very, very strong, very creative, very proficient in communicating visually their ideas. My passion has always been around communicating things in a way that they're intuitive, they're effective, they're useful. And so for me, it's always been a passion around making sure that someone can accomplish a task, ensuring that when they walk up to use your product, they know what the product actually does and how to use it. You know, don't make them read a manual, that kind of thing. So I've always been passionate about making sure that things are effective and efficient for your users. And I think that that's a good intersection to have with partners who are more creative and are more focused on design.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, like you said, there's nothing worse than someone being like, well, it's in the manual. You're like, oh, well, then there's definitely something wrong. And also, I mean, I think good design speaks to a lot of us, but good design really is when it allows us to accomplish something,
Correct. Right?
It's not just design for design's sake. But, you know, but it's interesting too, because when you talk about being intuitive and effective and useful for the user, I think there's also a part of a design roles where you have to communicate in a way to the business so they understand why it's effective and useful and a good use of the kind of investment there as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. And if I didn't mention it already, human factors is essentially the study of work. And so when you think about whether it's something from a gaming perspective or a social perspective or something you really use at work, it's all about getting something done, which is work. And so when you think about the two sides of that, there's the communication, like you just said, with your engineering partners who have to create that thing, and you want it to come out as close to the effective, efficient solution that you envisioned. But more importantly, you've got to be able to effectively communicate that to your business partners, because your investment, you know, your cross-functional partners in marketing and sales and all those other parts of the organization need to understand the value and the positioning around that solution. And so when you think about your role or responsibility, it's not just about the actual output or artifact. It's also about making sure that you can justify the need, you can justify the design and that sort of thing to your business just as much as engineering.
Yeah. No, I mean, that also kind of unlocks your ability to do the things that you're so passionate about that you've heard from the audience that you want to be able to do. And I know one of the other, like, you've done so much both from an education perspective and in your careers and roles. And you've also sort of moved through your career from an individual contributor to a design leader. And then now, of course, you have your consultancy. Mm-hmm. But along that way, I mean, that's a big change, right? And that goes from I know how I need to position my work to I know how to reposition the work. So talk a little bit about how you did that and how you use all those different experiences to really make that leap effective.
Yeah, I like the way that you frame that. It starts with kind of the micro level of what I contribute. And in any leadership role I've ever held, I've always ensured that the team was focused on that micro deliverable, but they also kind of stepped back and looked around them to make sure they understood the macro. So at the bigger picture level, how does your individual work contribute to the broader outcome? And that's where I had to evolve my career. So as I recognized at some point in the process of being a practitioner and a researcher and a designer, at some point I recognized that I crave to have those conversations at the level of justifying or presenting the concept even before it was anything tangible that we could see. I realized that that was something that I was also interested in, and that partnership with the business. And so from there, I saw the opportunity to evolve my career and make intentional decisions to take on roles or stretch goals or things that might have been uncomfortable that allowed me to use that core kind of understanding of the user, you know, human-centered design framework. It allowed me to use that as a tool or a conduit and not necessarily the direct output of what I do.
I think that's really interesting though, too, because I think sometimes people feel like whether it's a designer going into design lead role or a product person going into a product leadership role, like you feel like you have to not use the skills that got you here to get to the next level. And of course, you know, there is a difference between there, but also sometimes the best way to move to that management level is to use the skills that you have and your own expertise in that new role. And I think that sometimes you think, oh no, I've got to put like my manager hat on now and leave all of that sort of research and the way we communicate and how we use some of those storytelling superpowers we have, that we leave them behind because we think, no, not in this role should I use those. I think it's great that you really flipped the script on that.
Yeah. And to your point, all of those tools in the UX person's toolkit, they're not meant to be left behind. Like you said, you pull them out, you're just utilizing them in a different way. And if you think about, if you do, you know, you have like handy jobs or hobbies around the house, you can go from, you know, basic repairs to actually creating something new that becomes a fixture or a piece of furniture in your house. But it's that evolution of your skills. But at the core, you're using your skills of picking up that tool and applying it to make something. And so I look at it the same way where, like you said, storytelling. You know, storytelling for me in some cases was an opportunity to sit across the table from my product management partners and to tell the story of the user in a way they hadn't heard it before. Mm-hmm. So they understood the motivations, the pains our customers were feeling, the needs that they had that were unmet needs, maybe inside or outside of our business, that then allowed us to have new conversations around partnerships. Or, you know, do we build this as a part of our solution? And those conversations wouldn't have come up if I didn't leverage some of those UX skills that were in my toolkit. And also I used to think about and talk to my other human factors and UX partners in other companies. We used to talk about the fact that for those of us that have degrees in psychology, shame on us if we don't use that in our role as managers. Mm-hmm. And those skills that we learned in psychology around active listening, and, you know, what you experience when you're going through a therapeutic sort of conversation. If we don't use those, again, shame on us for not realizing that we should come to the table with a little bit more in terms of that empathy for our customer, but also for our employee.
Absolutely. And I also think not only does it make a very effective manager, but it also allows you to be very true to yourself, right? To be in a management and leadership role, but still be able to feed and satisfy that part of you. It's like why you got into this in the first place, right? Again, when you think you have to don like a whole different uniform, like it doesn't feed you in the same way. So it's a way to be both effective and to be satisfied. And to your point, like shame on us if we're not using those skills at that next level.
Yeah. And you know, it's, you know, a lot of the conversations I've had lately are around being a Black woman and having a role in IT and the challenges that come with that in terms of partnerships with others in the organization when I was in-house, for example. But I have to say that as much as there were those challenges, there were also for me those opportunities in terms of, I'll never forget, I had a coworker who VP of product, and whenever I'd go to him after I wrote this lengthy, robust, you know, fact-filled email on what we needed to do and why for our customer, whenever I'd go to him after a few days and ask him his thoughts, or I haven't heard back from you, he gave me the runaround a couple of times. And then finally one day he said, you know, your emails are too long and I don't read them. And it's things like that where when I was at my macro practitioner level, all that detail might've been helpful. But as I progressed in my career and got to a more strategic role or, you know, a more top-down type of lens in my contribution to the organization, I had to start looking at how I communicate and what I communicate. And to be effective, I can't provide the same level of detail.
No, it's true. It's such a part of why you know your work is good at the individual contributor level. Like you have all these details, but it's not what convinces someone else. And it's another reason why to use your design skills, knowing your audience and flipping, because you demonstrating that to your peer, in essence, is also demonstrating the power of your team and of designers in general, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like these skills that you think, wow, she's really great at facilitating these conversations or telling me those stories internally, then it kind of gives even more credence to the rest of your team's efforts, which I think is amazing. Tell me a little bit about Lean Geeks. What got you started there and what you guys do?
Yeah. So going back to sometimes being on my kind of island of one, maybe being the only female in the room or the only Black person in the room, I got to a place where I was ready for a new opportunity. And I had been primarily in in-house roles. And I got to a place where I said, well, I can go to pursue a new opportunity at a different company. Now, having seen things from both the practitioner and the strategic level, I felt like I had kind of two lenses that I could utilize in any role that I took on. But I said to myself, there's a component of within UX leadership, there's a component of evangelism and going to bat for your team that is, and also being the glue across the organization in terms of kind of bringing the business and engineering together. And I had never seen an organization where that did not exist. Whether there were different levels of maturity, obviously, but I knew that those three things would always be a facet of my responsibilities and my role. And so I said to myself, I either have to go into a new organization and start all over, or I can take my show on the road and all my experiences and my network and all that sort of thing and take it out to organizations that are looking for it, that are in a place that they're at different levels of maturity, but they're looking for a partner who's going to deliver. And that's why I call the company Lean Geeks, or named it Lean Geeks. Was sometimes in my career, I got the, you know, oh, you're a PhD and you guys make it so complicated and you give us too much. We just need the headline. And so I wanted to make sure that in partnering with the company, clients understood that we bring it to them in a lean, scrappy when necessary way so that they can get what they need to make decisions and move forward.
Yeah, I do think sometimes design gets painted with that brush, right? Like the, we'll bring designers or they're going to go, you know, they're going to take the house back to the studs and it's going to take 10 times longer. And it's a shame, right? When you think about the value. And I could totally see lean showing both the thinner process and quicker time, but also the results orientation there. So with the organizations you work with, do you work with design teams within the organizations and sort of help sort of maybe either supplement them or I hate to say level up, not like they're not, but you know, help them kind of mature?
So our partnerships typically involve engaging strategy, product, or design teams. And it depends on where they are in the evolution in terms of, are they in the discovery phase and trying to figure out what it is versus do they already have a prototype available and they want to validate, is this the right experience, or help us get to that design and to validate it along the way? So it all depends on where the organization is. But we live in the discovery, definition, and design space in terms of the partnerships that we do have. We have had situations where, like you said, quote unquote, we help level up the team in terms of either there's gaps in seniority on their team. They don't have bandwidth because they have so much work and so few people. Mm-hmm. They don't have time to staff the team up, or they need our help finding the next person that might be a good fit for their team. So we've helped design teams in that way. And then with product teams, we've helped them get more clarity around their messaging to the rest of the organization around what they're doing and why. And we've helped them in terms of what to define in their solution. Our focus, if you think about the pragmatic framework, our focus is typically around those areas that relate to competitive landscape, understanding your user's journey, that sort of thing. And so we help them in that regard. And then they come together with us around pricing or positioning and that kind of thing.
And I think whether or not they explicitly go to you for this, you are in fact demoing the type of skills, the type of, you know, human-centered approach, the type of impact this kind of thinking and design approach can have on there that leaves the organizations better for it, just because they see the possibilities and it makes people rethink how they're looking at partners across the way.
Absolutely. I like the way you restated that, because like we had a situation recently where we were brought in to validate some new capabilities within a solution that our client was looking at creating. We went through the process of talking to some of their customers, creating wireframes, but then coming out of that project, they recognize, hey, we need a product manager on this. Can we use that same person who did the research and design? Can we have her stand in as a product management proxy for the team? Because our current product management team doesn't have the bandwidth. So I think in that engagement, to your point, sometimes our clients recognize the value of UX goes beyond pixels on a page or validating those pixels on a page. And so that makes me just like warm inside. Yes. And I get so giddy because I'm like, oh my goodness, this is what you hope for in your career, that whether you're inside of an organization or just partnering in general, that's all you can hope for.
Well, I suppose as designers, I mean, I think we've all been in this situation. They bring in someone from the outside and maybe your first reaction is, oh, you know, I could do that if I had more bandwidth. And it's true in many different ways, but like bandwidth is a real thing. What if it can be demonstrated either if you can do it or someone outside, what those processes can do, that it isn't just extra space and extra time, but the real impact and value it can have, that will open doors for everyone else as well. Like it really does kind of
absolutely. And we like to strengthen the voice of the existing team. So where we can help to legitimize the UX capability in that organization, hey, that's all that matters to us. And once we're gone, if it gives you more credibility, wonderful. If you need us to come back and help again, that's where we come in and coach, that kind of thing.
But I know in your career, both as a designer, leading design teams, and now here, you see a lot of different teams and a lot of different designers. You know, if you were going back into the you know, brand new company starts and they're like, you know, come in Kenya and start a new team, like, what would you look for in a team? What are those attributes, the experience, the skills that you're like, this is how I would build the base of a really strong team?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. If I was to look at building a strong team, I would look at what are those core capabilities that are necessary. Someone or more than one person's got to be user focused. So there's got to be some responsibilities around going out and talking to the customer, making sure that in that process of creation, that there is someone that knows when to go out and validate. So you got to test and learn. You can't just go off into the lab and then come out with the big reveal. You've got to have that constant test and learn. Also facilitation. I think a lot of teams lack facilitation skills within their UX organizations. And so to me, it's important to ensure that you have individuals that have those capabilities, because if I can tell a story and if all I can do is tell an effective story, but then I don't know where to take that in terms of now gathering, you know, insights from the existing team or getting the team to brainstorm on ideas on how to implement those things that have come out of that story, then I'm really doing a disservice to that data. Because it's just like, you know, it's just like the big data problem where you have all this data, but you don't know what to do with it. So I think that those facilitation skills are important as well. I always think that you've got to have people who are comfortable and live and breathe in that space of creating. So everyone can't be a strategist. Everyone can't walk around with a cup of coffee, throwing out ideas and telling somebody to go do it. Some people have to actually do the work as well. And so having people who really, you know, are passionate about creating and at a detailed level, those skills are necessary.
It's a great reminder too. I think sometimes when we're talking about strategic design, we're focusing over here and like, we're like, but end of the day, like
somebody's got to do something.
You have to execute. And we should never discount those who not only execute well, but love to be there, because the work they do reflects that.
I also think that you have to have operations. Obviously, someone's got to think about getting the work done. One of the biggest struggles I saw in my time as a leader in UX is people not recognizing how important it is to get something done in a timely fashion, because you are a step in the process. And so if you prolong your step or don't give credence to the fact that when you were given a deadline, you got to meet your deadline, that means you can't keep designing. You got to stop at some point. If you're not capable of that, then you can derail the value and respect of the team.
I think that's one of the places where your background and having that some of that technical spot, like, you know what you're feeding into firsthand and how important hitting, like you said, it's a really important step, but it is one step and all of those steps have to hit. And obviously we all know that the place that gets most compressed is at the very end of the process, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, at the core, I think those are the things that are necessary.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that gives you a really well-rounded team from a skill set perspective as well. And then similarly, having kind of represented teams and the impact they can have both inside as an external consultant, if those listening who lead a team, is some advice that you would give them about how to help the rest of the organization really see the impact of not just their designers, but design in general?
I love to piggyback off of something that I really enjoyed during my time in-house was piggybacking off of other events and doing things like road shows and contests like hackathons, but doing design-a-thons. I loved to do things like that where you pull in your partners. And this is, you know, why I like teaching human-computer interaction in the computer science department, is because it's about teaching software engineering students that you have a place in making sure you validate your concepts. You think you designed something that was effective? Yeah, it works, but does it work for a user? You know, so I have always seen that partnership in the design process but respecting that your design team and design experts are the ones you lean on for some of those more niche capabilities or needs, I've always seen that as important in terms of getting the word out around what UX is and how the value of UX can be leveraged in an organization.
You mentioned a couple of times on this podcast being sometimes the only woman in a room or the only person of color in a room. And I know it's a topic that you've talked a lot about, right? Sort of user research of the diversity sort of underrepresented in general, but certainly also underrepresented in UX and research. And I think to some, like it increases the biases, right? Obviously. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping, like, from your perspective, advice that you would give companies that are really looking to embrace diversity and equity and inclusion, both on their teams and in the sort of products and that they create.
That's a good one. So you got to hire leaders that are more diverse, different. If everyone in the room looks similar, they're more than likely going to converge on ideas that are similar. And so you don't have that thinking that goes outside of what everyone else is thinking. And it's easy for us to connect with or to feel comfortable with those that look like us. Mm-hmm. But for those of us that have been in the room and most people didn't look like us, it's easier to recognize when things are homogenous.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things where push yourself on finding diversity. And I know there's been a lot out there in terms of, oh, there aren't enough or they aren't there. It's probably where you're looking. Yeah. That's the challenge. Also, I find personally, I've had several huge companies reach out to me more than once over email and LinkedIn and that kind of thing to ask me to take on a leadership role in their organization. While very flattering, it's also kind of insulting. Because I've created and built up a company and a brand of my own. And for you to not respect and see that as an opportunity to partner instead of, oh, come work for us because we're great. It to me, again, you're showing that same sort of behavior that makes it less appealing for me to consider come working for your organization. And some people may see that as, well, why wouldn't she want this? Well, the very reason I quit my job and started my own company is the reason why I want to work with varied companies. So you have to think about hiring for diversity, and sometimes hiring is not always a direct hire. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's partnerships. I've also recognized in the work that we do, for example, I've pushed my teams on making sure that we recruit diverse panelists. So when we do research, we've got to do the hard work to find those groups of people that are harder to gain access to and find ways to engage them. What are finding those strategies that work in terms of increasing those numbers so that we can have varied voices and make sure that we're presenting to our client the representative, the truly representative feedback of their market. So those are two things.
No, and I think you're spot on the recruiting, right? It's easy, you hear it a lot that we just didn't get candidates. And well, if you're asking your existing network for suggestions, your network looks like one way, you know what I mean? You have to work for it. There is a responsibility to work and look and find. And I think the panelist thing is really important as well. I think it's important to remember, in the same way we talk all the time with product managers, like, it's great if you make nursing software and you used to be a nurse, but you don't represent all nurses and your behaviors are like, so no matter what your internal team looks like, it will not be able to speak for everyone, and it shouldn't speak for everyone in any way. And getting the diverse panels for testing is, again, it's hard work. But it pays dividends in ways you can't think of. I know in my own career, probably one of the most, for me, just like things I never would have thought for in a million years, despite thinking I would, is some of the different abilities, right? Different levels of ability and testing for that. Because, we all have our own blind spots. I have a billion of them I'm sure not aware of, but I like fell flat into that one just with the immensity of how much I had never thought of. that never would happen if we didn't bring those voices to the table.
It's true. No, it's very true. And it's funny, I had a colleague at a big tech firm talk about the fact that he is in a research role. And he said, you know, the attempt to get connected to more Black people in the organization and to validate some concepts that we had was to go and talk to Black developers and Black QA people. And so we both, you know, laughed at the bias of, okay, these are people who are highly educated, more than likely understand tech at a level that's greater than the average person. And so we kind of went through all those things mm-hmm. that you can easily forget yeah. in just connecting with, oh, well, here are some people that are right in front of me. Let me get a few data points. But those aren't truly representative or necessarily representative of your user.
And I think the other thing is everything evolves so fast that mm-hmm. you have to go out and get different views on a regular basis. There's no yeah. point where you're like, ah, I understand that point of view now. I'll check it off my list of things I need to keep checking. It's definitely not the case. I also know that you mentor and coach some people of color who are working. What kind of advice for listeners? Is there anything mm-hmm. in particular you would do for advice?
You ask so many good questions.
I do like an hour with everyone I know.
So I have actually coached young people, people of color, people not of color. I don't know what that doesn't sound right. We all have a color, we're clear. So when I think about coaching, a lot of where I go to goes back to my roots in psychology.
Yep.
And it's about your unique inherent capabilities and that we have to look. Some of us are driven by things that are externally, or we're externally motivated. Some of us are intrinsically motivated by different things. And so when you think about what motivates you, for example, you want to first identify, is it implicitly what's inside of me or is it the things around me? So you have to start to tap into some of those things about yourself and recognize, what do I enjoy versus what am I good at? So I might be very good at certain things, but I don't necessarily enjoy them. Sometimes that requires you ask other people, what do they immediately think about or what comes to mind when they think about you and your skills? And so being able to leverage a little bit of research about yourself, you know, being able to leverage that and to utilize that and understanding that social media makes it easy for us to want to compare ourselves to others, but we've got to be careful about not or forgetting the unique aspects of we each have a unique experience and story that makes us who we are. And your ability to leverage that, I think, is where true success comes in.
It's funny. It is one of the hardest lessons to learn that the things that you're good at aren't necessarily the things you love.
Yeah.
But I also think what you said, when you can kind of lean into who you really are, it's like we were talking about, if you use your design skills to make you a better manager, it makes you a happier person. Yeah. And I think leaning into who you are, you will succeed more, partly because you are happier. You are authentic, which means you don't have to remember to play a role or to put up different answers or to do things, because you get to play in a much more authentically you spot. Mm-hmm. And then you just have to find a company and a role where that authentic, right? Like that, it's the match where your authenticity fits their needs and is valued there. And when you do, it's a wonderful place to be.
Mm-hmm. That like really, that takes everything home, because for any of us, that's true joy outside of the joy of family and love. Mm-hmm. Like that's true happiness and joy, is to find that place where you can be your authentic self and you can be successful at, you know, what you were brought in to do.
And I think that's why when people reach out, while flattering to some degree, you're like, no, I've built the place where I can be authentically me, because I couldn't be somewhere else. And you're just not picturing that, are you? And I think that's true for a lot of people who go out and start their own thing. Like they recognize that about themselves. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a gift that some people may also think they want to do that aren't as gifted to kind of lead their own organization as well.
Yeah. No, well said.
So we've talked about a lots of different stuff today, Kenya. If you were going to have people do, it's always one of my favorite questions, do two things differently tomorrow based on what we talked about today, what would you have them do?
Two things I would have people do differently is before you assume something, especially about someone else and why or how they do something, I would ask, them.
Sounds so simple. And yet how many of us stop and do it?
Yeah. I would ask them why they do it that way, because sometimes people have no rhyme or reason. It's just, they didn't know any better. So, you know, I would stop and ask, and that's with anything, you know, raising kids. We sometimes scold our kids for things and they're like, but I didn't know any better.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. So I would ask and listen. Secondly, I would ask people, when you're talking to someone and they say something to you, restate in your own words what you just heard them say and tell them, I want to make sure that I heard what you just said and I'm going to restate it differently. And when you do that, you realize that a lot of times the miscommunication or confusion that we have when interacting with other people is sometimes our translation or perception of what they said and not truly what they were trying to communicate.
I think that's super smart too. It's one of those things that it gets like a game of telephone too, right? If I mistranslate this and I never check in, then the next thing you do is built on that translation I created, and it ends up getting us really far apart.
Yeah. And think about product development. It's that game of telephone that gets us to a place where we came in with requirements around this and then we ended up with that.
I have to tell you, it's one of the things that we have got one instructional designer here. We've got lots of great people, but one instructional designer, I always tease her because she asks really good questions as she's framing back, right? She's like, let me just listen. Let me like repeat that and ask a clarifying question. And I always tease her because she doesn't let me get away with any of the loose language, right? Mm-hmm. Like some of the time, you know, you're just like going along being your VP of like dropping things. And you like, when I ask questions, there's not enough depth there. Right. But it's a wonderful conversation, and it makes me really think about it. And I think it provides significantly better understanding for people that way. So.
Yeah.
All right, Kenya, if people want to follow along with your work, which I highly recommend they do, everything I've ever read from you and every time we have conversations with our organization and you, I adore it. Where should people find you? Where can they find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. That's probably where I'm most active. I'm trying to get things up and running and current on YouTube. So between LinkedIn and YouTube, you'll be able to find a lot of what I'm talking about, what matters the most to me, that sort of thing.
Excellent. All right, Kenya, thank you very much. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much. And I enjoyed it.
Great. All right. Thanks everyone for listening. And for design teams looking to contribute strategically and drive value, continue to follow this podcast and check out pragmaticinstitute.com/design. And don't forget to join us next time for another great topic.